Look, up in the air. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's We Got the Geek.
Hey, Geeksters, this is Jody and Ryan, and we've got something special for you today. So put away your usual superhero costumes and put on those white gis and your white belts, because this is the We Got the Geek Martial Arts Edition.
Awesome. That was actually a pretty awesome intro, sir.
Thank you.
I think today has been a long time coming. We've been discussing this probably, I would have to say, what, a good 3 months? Even with our producer today, the amazing Jay Stu. Thanks, Jay, for producing again for us today.
Oh, you're welcome, dude.
I think this is going to be the first of, again, many, maybe once a month, hopefully, martial arts, where we discuss about the different clubs, different movies, comics. There's just so much with the martial arts we can discuss. But today, I'm actually looking forward to seeing your thoughts on this, Jody. Just, I think ever since we started working together, we started talking about just the martial arts and just what kind of stuff that we're into as far as what we've known, what we've done. And just by talking to you, apparently we actually enjoy some of the same martial arts movies. In fact, I think you got me some Bruce Lee movies.
Yes.
Which, again, that will be for future shows. We'll be discussing about Bruce Lee. But today's topic, we're going to be talking about Brandon Lee. And we've chosen... he's done a few movies up, unfortunately, until his untimely death in the early 90s. But today we'll be discussing Showdown in Tokyo, which was one of the first movies we'll be discussing tonight. Second movie of Brandon Lee's would be Rapid Fire. And then the third, with probably one of my all-time favorite when it comes up to like a top 10 list, is The Crow, which unfortunately I think was one of his last movies. But I'm looking forward to see your thoughts on that tonight.
Yeah, that was also one of my actually favorites as well. There's so many good things about that. Unfortunately, like you say, it's his last film, so way to end it, but you know,
unfortunately,
it's unfortunate.
True. What I think we briefly talked before we started the show today, just to seeing how he evolved from just seeing him in Showdown in Tokyo up to The Crow. Like, it just would be amazing to see 20 years later, believe it or not, just where would he be, right?
Yeah. It's hard to say what he would be doing. I know he was kind of getting back into the martial arts aspect of things because mm-hmm. he wanted to... he kind of started... his whole thing was, well, he's living in the shadow of his father, mm-hmm. Bruce Lee. And that's a big, you know, shadow to fall under.
For
so
sure.
He had ended up being that he just didn't want to do anything with the martial arts at that time in his life. So I think as he got older, he started coming to... understand really where he fell into the scheme of things and accepted, you know, the martial arts and who his father was and all that stuff. So he ends up coming out of the shadow of his father, as I mentioned, and getting into other films or areas that he wanted to do aside from the martial arts, because he didn't want to become pigeonholed into just one type of film. So we'll be talking about kind of more about that as we go along, too.
Oh, definitely. I was just looking at the Internet Movie Database. You're talking about trying to come out from under his dad's shadow. One of his first films, because his first film actually has him as uncredited, something called The Crime Killer. He played a gangster in that one.
Right.
But one of the first, I guess, TV movies, I'm sure all of our listeners know, was Kung Fu, the movie. I still remember that growing up. I think he played, like, a younger version. But you know the story behind that one, that Bruce Lee's the one that actually came up.
Yeah, he was the one that came up with the idea.
It's funny, I was watching a documentary that the producer-director thought he was too Asian.
Right.
Which I thought was way too funny. Like, it's based off Kung Fu. I mean, so I just thought it was funny seeing Brandon Lee sort of play a younger version of the character in that. So.
Right, going back a step there, you got to put yourself back in the 60s and how a lot of racism was going on
sure.
in that, especially against Asians as well. And it was one of those things where it was being on TV, so they were like, well, you know, we kind of want someone to look Asian, but we want someone that's not Asian, so that's...
Wasn't David Carradine the star of the original?
Yeah, David Carradine was the actor.
He did not look Asian in the
movies. No.
But, I mean, David Carradine also carried into the TV show in the early 90s, I believe, as well, right?
Yeah.
So, but I just thought it was funny, like, you got to figure, man, just starting out, trying to get... sort of started on his own, and then he sort of plays a role that initially was
ends up somewhere else. Yeah, that's interesting because it also happened. There was a film called The Silent Flute, which he, I think the name changed when it became the movie. I'm not 100% on that. But it ends up being that he came up with this great concept. He was trying to bring philosophy and trying to take it and visualize it and bring it out to the audience through movies and that sort of thing. And it ended up being that someone else ended up being in the role instead of him. Can't remember exactly. It's been quite some time since I saw that film, but it was a long time ago, that one.
Well, I'm just looking at Internet Movie Database, IMDb, for our listeners. It really shows technically, like, it has them as couple TV shows. There's the Kung Fu the Movie, the TV movie. There's a CBS Summer Playhouse TV series. There's another TV series called O'Hara, and then there was something called Laser Mission for a movie in 89.
Yeah.
Showdown in Tokyo for...
O'Hara, going back to that, that was the 1980, he was a guest appearance, and he was actually with Pat Moriarty, who was the fellow from Karate Kid.
Wax on, wax off.
He was the teacher from Karate Kid. So he was playing a villain, actually called Kenji, in that film,
the TV episode.
Yeah.
Well, the first out of the three movies, it shows that Showdown in Little Tokyo, I think, was maybe his mainstream, I think, was as far as U.S. movies are concerned. This was his first movie that he teamed up with Dolph Lundgren. So Brandon Lee, Dolph Lundgren, and then another actor who I loved in Nash Bridges was an actor by the name of Kerry Hiyuki Tagawa.
Yeah, he played the villain.
He was their chief on Nash Bridges.
Yep.
With his ponytail.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's played in numerous, I'm sure, martial arts film we'll be discussing with him as an actor, but... he played the villain, part of the Yakuza in this one. And also, an actress which you guys might know is Tia Carrera.
One of her
early films. So
she sings in this one, yeah.
I believe this is one of her first films as well.
She had an album.
yeah, unfortunately she had an album. Because in the film, her singing wasn't that great.
Well, to that, it's going to be the first movie on our tonight's review. At least that's how I watched them, was pretty much in order. So, Tokyo,
followed the same.
Rapid Fire, and then The Crow. The film...
interject there. Prior to that, there was a film called Laser Mission in 1990, which he did, which I saw and was really bad, cheesy knockout version of... James Bond, actually.
Okay.
Mixed in with some martial arts a little bit.
Yeah, that's when that came out.
But it was mainly just a lot of acting and stuff for him. So.
Well, who knows? Maybe on our future endeavors we might discuss other... Because I'm assuming it still had a martial arts kind of element to it.
Not really. That one was pretty much just acting and storyline, James Bond, spy stuff.
IMDb just sort of has it as a mercenary gold is sent from the CIA to seize the laser expert in Cuba before the KGB catches him.
Right.
All the cliches. And
yeah, everything was so bad. It's so B-movie, it's not even funny.
That's funny. Well, the first movie in our review tonight, it's the Showdown in Tokyo. And that movie came out, where's it showing here? Looks like 1991. So it's definitely going back some time. And as the director, it goes by the name of Mark Lester. Some of the other films he would have done is Jay and Jody, you guys might know this, Firestarter, 1984.
Yeah.
He also did Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's in 85.
Okay.
He also did Armed and Dangerous. So that's 1986 with John Candy.
Yeah.
So I remember these movies. It's been a while, but that's...
Drew Barrymore, I think, was the kid in Firestarter.
Yep, that is
and
correct.
And that was off Stephen King's work.
The writers for it are Stephen Glantz and Calliope Brattlestreet are the ones that actually wrote Showdown in Tokyo. And again, some of the stars are Dolph Lundgren, Brandon Lee, Kerry Hiyuki Tagawa, and Tia Carrera. Now, just some of the actors, obviously we all recognize the name. Dolph Lundgren's been in over 57 movies. Most recently, The Expendables, which in some of maybe our other movie reviews, I think we may have done some of them, but with obviously the next expectation of Expendables 3, so maybe we should discuss that. Kerry Hiyuki Tagawa has actually been in over 109 films. So I was actually quite interesting to see how many films he's actually been in. My most favorite for him, though, is Nash Bridges. I love that show.
Right. I can't believe you're a fan of that show. I am, too.
Oh, I love that. Like, even when they did changes after the couple seasons, but
yeah.
I sucked when I found out they canceled. I'm like, no.
They had a good run, though. It was six or seven seasons, I think.
Oh, no, for sure.
And he was in The Phantom, another comic book movie.
Oh, yeah.
I think who was that with Billy?
Billy Zane, yeah.
Oh, wow, with the purple.
With the purple skull ring.
I haven't seen that in ages.
I most recently saw him in a few episodes of the new Hawaii Five-0,
yeah,
actually.
He actually played Yakuza Buzz in that one. Unfortunately, no, spoilers, he does end up dying.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one yet. That one.
Now you just have to decide which episode he dies in. And unfortunately, the other actor, which is the main topic of tonight's show, is Brandon Lee, who unfortunately his untimely death in 1994. Through the different movies we're reviewing tonight.
Let me correct you on that. 1993. March 31st. The movie came out in 1994, The Crow. His death was in 1993.
So it was a
March
year 31st.
After.
I probably should save this when you talk about The Crow, but were they still working on the movie when he died? Like,
yes.
Did they still have stuff to do?
They had to do some sort of photo.
They had a week left of filming. Then, actually, he was off to get, after that, he was supposed to get married in Mexico and April 17th, 1993 as well. So it was like boom, 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 like, everything kind of happened.
Yeah.
And
I can't believe that's 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. He was buried in Seattle, actually, on April 3rd, next to his father, Bruce. They have graves beside each other, which is one place my brother lives, actually, in Seattle, just outside of it. So I've always wanted to go up there and actually see the burials and that sort of thing. It's supposed to be pretty nice. He was supposed to marry, or at the time of his death, he was engaged to Eliza Hutton. So at the end of The Crow, they give a homage to both of them. This is dedicated to Brandon and Eliza.
Yeah.
So that was neat. His birth name is Brandon Bruce Lee, so he actually has his father's middle name as his. And, he speaks Cantonese and English, obviously. And he's actually Chinese, Swedish, English, and German descent. So not many people may know that.
Well, I do know he lived in, I think it was Hong Kong.
Yeah, he lived in Hong Kong for a little bit, and then he left there to come to the States. He was his Chinese star sign is the dragon, which is interesting, and he was born on the Chinese New Year's Eve. And which is the last day of the dragon. So the dragon kind of flows into a lot of things with that family. His father's two films, Enter the Dragon, Return of the Dragon, that sort of thing. So it's kind of interesting in that regard, how things tie up and that sort of thing.
Well, it definitely is unfortunate due to the timing of his death. Just knowing the different movies as you move on, just how much better he's getting. Like, I mean, you just watched some of his earlier films.
Yes.
And sorry, how old was he when he passed away?
He was actually 28.
Oh, wow, that's pretty young, man.
Yeah, yeah. He was still pretty young. Because he was born February 1st, 1965 in Oakland, California. So, yeah, he was pretty young when he passed away. And he was just like his father as well, it was just at the cusp of, he was starting to get well-known.
Definitely.
People were, you know, going, hey, we want this guy. And it was interesting because he was actually signed on for an extended deal with 20th Century Fox to do multiple pictures. In this case, he had two more after Rapid Fire. So they were actually working on Rapid Fire 2. And it's kind of sad to see. You were talking about, I wonder what would happen, you know, down the road if he hadn't died so soon. So we probably would have seen some Rapid Fire 2,
maybe.
Possibly a third one,
maybe
or
a
something
Crow
different.
Proper Crow 2, even.
Proper Crow 2, yeah.
Or even 3, if they got that far, yeah.
Right, yeah. So there's a lot of many questions that were unanswered, or, you know, what ifs, right? So,
yeah. Well, on a lighter side of things, like we'll talk about his first U.S. movie.
Cool.
But we'll just come back after a break. See you guys in a bit.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Mostly Comics has been serving the Niagara region for over 30 years. The store sells a variety of comics and entertainment-related products, including graphic novels, toys, and collectibles. Mostly also purchases rare comics upon appraisal. Visit Kim and the Gang at 413 St. Paul Street in St. Catharines, or check out their website at www.mostlycomics.com.
And welcome back, guys, to We Got the Geek Martial Arts Edition, first of many. Got my co-host today, Jody, who I think I've created a monster with our different podcasts. I believe, Jody, was a few weeks ago we got you. I finally, after 2 or 3 months of sort of convincing you to come onto our comic panel, and I think history ever since.
Yeah, start something good, so I commend you on that. Thanks. And it was just some of that work we were talking about one day, and we were bouncing around some ideas, and it's kind of turning into what we have now.
Well, that's how it started, is like I said, hopefully once a month we can try to get something martial arts. There's so much.
Well, we're going to try for it. We'll see how it goes, but we'll definitely have a lot more. There's a few other ones we have planned and we're excited about. So.
Well, I'm looking forward to see what else you have planned. Yeah. So I wanted to see what kind of monster created.
It'll be great.
In fact, one of the first movies I think you recommended tonight was the Showdown in Tokyo, which is the first movie we're discussing.
Right.
I've seen all of the movies, obviously, many years ago. It was kind of cool seeing it again. But just seeing your cheesy 80s martial arts flicks. It was weird seeing, you got to figure, Dolph Lundgren and Brandon Lee. Just Brandon Lee's like a clean-cut partner, teams up with Dolph Lundgren, who loses many partners. A little bit of the synopsis.
Yeah, Brandon played kind of like the wisecracker in this one.
Yeah,
and I found it funny because they cross-type cast him in the case because... When they, in the film, he's asking him, you know, where are you from? And he goes, oh, I was born in, like, you know, the valley, and I ventured into malls, and that's the big stuff that we did. And he's like, where are you from? You know, and Dolph Lundgren's like, oh, I was in Japan, and I studied, you know, with the samurai and all this, you know, stuff.
Exactly.
He's like, meanwhile, in real life, it's kind of like the other way around, but
yeah,
fun and interesting.
So it's kind of interesting. Like I said, it's been years, but a little bit of the movie description is the detective, which is Dolph Lundgren, was orphaned as a child as his parents were killed in the military. He was actually killed by the villain in the house. Yep, was killed by the character Kerry Hiyuki Tagawa played. And then you fast forward to now, I think they're in L.A., if I'm not mistaken, and then Dolph Lundgren's character gets teamed up with Bruce Lee's character, and they go after this character. At the first meeting is when they're in the Japanese restaurant. And then here you have Dolph Lundgren just with this cup, and then he's against the Yakuza who are trying to get money, protection money, and he's like fighting them with the cup tea in his hand. So like I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, it starts out with Dolph actually in the breaking up the Yakuza's kind of illegal betting and gambling.
Or like the fighting ring.
In the fighting ring, and he swings in real dramatic, like Indiana Jones style, comes swinging in.
From the roof.
Yeah, and he starts taking over the place, and I'm surprised they didn't just shoot him dead there, because there's so many guys with guns there, and he just barges in.
Not to mention, I don't think you're going to miss like a 6 foot, however tall.
Yeah, he's pretty tall. He towers over all these guys, and then they start betting on him, and he's like, excellent bet. And then he starts duking it out with these guys, basically doing a lot of Hollywood kind of kicks and flashy stuff.
Well, you can hear the
thing.
Yeah. Like, it's noticeable. It's not like when you punch somebody in real life, but you can actually hear them add the when they're punching somebody, kicking somebody, which I thought was funny.
Right. Yeah, it was very much the way the movie was done. I think they planned it. Let's do a B-type movie.
Yeah.
And it was like that from the get-go, and it was kind of, I think, vehicled around Dolph Lundgren. But when I remember originally seeing it, I was totally blown away because Brandon, I think, to me, stole the show from Dolph, and they were playing like good cop, bad cop off each other. So it was kind of like, for me, it was all about Brandon at that point in time. And it was like, who is this guy? I never seen this guy before, you know? And at that time, I did know who he was, but to see him actually in a full-fledged film was pretty awesome. Because, as you were mentioning earlier, it was the TV show Kung Fu where I first saw him. And I got really excited. I was like, okay, his son's finally grown up. He's now getting into film and TV and that sort of thing. So I followed him, like, for a number of years. So he, to me, was my Bruce Lee, like, to others who were around when Bruce was alive and doing the films that he's done. So, that's kind of like how it all started for me in that case. And that's what drew my attention to that that film.
Well, it was that you mentioned about being the B-movie. You are right. I mean, it's still entertaining. Like, I mean, just like you were talking about how you have Brandon Lee's character where he's just an American, didn't really know about his culture because his mom made him take arts classes. But then you have Dolph Lundgren's character who actually built like a Japanese home.
Right.
Japanese hot tub and the scene with
Tia sliding Carter. Up to the sliding doors, paper. Exactly. On him. It was amazing. I liked that, the house. I was so upset when I saw it actually go up in smoke. I'm like, no, it's so awesome.
Well, I have to admit, just the chemistry between the two actors. I mean, number one, it's Dolph Lundgren. So, I mean, the chemistry with him in between other actors, I think they played off.
They played off. Well. Yes, I agree with that.
As far as would you see like a second movie made of that? I don't know.
No, I don't think so.
It's one of those things that it's like Dolph Lundgren got the girl and saved her a couple times. Actually, I think there was like three times he saved her. The other time when he went into the Yakuza's home, like you would think they'd shoot him. Like they don't care if he's a cop. Like you're not going to want to shoot a cop.
Now. That was like, actually a pretty funny scene because they're all pointing their guns at him and he's like, Brandon's like, dude, you know, we're kind of surrounded. And how are we getting out of here? Bar.
The first scene there?
Oh, the first scene, yes. When they're in the bar. Let's go back to that. Yeah, the first scene is actually the main fight scenes actually were that one. Well, in the ring to begin with, which is just a small one. And then there was the Yakuza's kind of holding up the lady saying, you know, we want some money. You'll
like in the, be protected, in the
you know, if you give us money. Because the other guy, he's gone now. Mm-hmm. I believe they killed him or something like that. So. Yeah.
That was in the car scene. They had him squashed.
Right.
The wreckers.
Right. Lovely.
Which is a classic if you watch film through the, like, the 80s and 90s. That's always a classic like mobster type.
Funny thing was I saw mentioning the decor cars and that. If you watch both Showdown and then you watch Rapid Fire, if you ever notice the cars, they're always like older 70s big model Cadillac kind of style never cars.
Notice that.
Yeah, it was kind of actually funny. I picked that up and I was like, wow, it's like nothing's really changed like between the films and the case of the cars and that sort of thing.
And
the
gangsters.
Yeah, and the gangsters in this one actually they all wore like suits, big shoulder pad kind of the film was 91, so we're probably in the late 80s kind of style at that point. And it was kind of interesting to see these gangsters who are supposed to be badass, but they're in like, you know, crazy 80s style you know, suits with small ties and stuff like that. So it was pretty funny.
Yeah, like I you know what? I enjoyed the movie. I mean, for what it is, like you got to figure if they were to do something like that now, it just would have been interesting to see if they were to do like a 2000 version of Showdown in Tokyo.
Yeah, because with all the revamps, it'd be interesting to see them bring it back. But
exactly.
Maybe not make it so B-movie, but make it a little bit more kick-ass. It'd be interesting to see that. The other thing I was noticing is the fight scenes were kind of campy in a way. And nowadays I find it kind of interesting because they don't really hold up to today's stuff. Today's a little bit more intense, more realistic driven. Look at the Bourne Identity trilogy and the fight scenes there. That's all like Kali, which is Filipino martial arts stuff. So you can kind of see that back then it was a little bit, they slowed it down. Like their fight scenes, I noticed, were a little bit slower moving and that sort of thing. So when they, but they were still doing a lot of the Filipino arts mixed with a lot of Hollywood, you know, flashy kicks and that sort of thing, karate style stuff. So,
well, I think nowadays too, it's like you have a lot of the actors wanting to do their own actual.
Yeah, they would get involved in it, and before it'd be like you have a stunt double come in and do the fight scenes.
Well, if you take an example from Jackie Chan, I don't think he has a stunt double.
No.
He's done all of his
pretty much.
So I mean, you have like the full on contact to make it realistic, right? Yeah. But you are right though. That's why I was making fun of like the sound effects, especially when Brandon Lee was coming. Oh come on! Like you can pick that up like on movies back then, but nowadays it's done so well. Like it's literally, it looks like you're hitting that person.
That's right. Yeah.
As far as the storyline itself, I mean, I think it's typical. You got this damsel in distress I mean, you got drugs, especially in any films in the 80s. It was your typical, what, mobsters, Yakuza.
Right. Saving a girl. And this one, I think it was it heroin or cocaine? Something?
I think it was, wasn't heroin. It was.
It must have been the cocaine. Oh, Kristen.
Wasn't it? Because it was the rocks that they found. Because remember in the beer store, or the brewery, they were putting like
the
rocks into the bottles, right?
That's right, yeah. And that's how they're distributing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just thought it was funny when they introduced all of like, your typical gangsters. So, like, your...
Yeah, everything was very cliche in this
like, your Mexican, your bikers...
That were supposed to help gangsters. To distribute the product.
I mean, the one scene, which was kind of funny... Is like I do like samurai swords or swords in general, and when Carrie's character takes a samurai sword on that one biker and chops his arms off while they're in the brewery. Do you remember that?
Right, he's leaning up against the one machine,
and he's like, "We're not."
He grabs the fellow's sword. Well, you know, I always walk around with a giant samurai sword myself. You know, it's a little easier, and he comes up and just slices his hand right off.
Mind you, it's either that or slice of bread. So
yeah,
a little bit overkill for a slice of bread.
He thought it was bread. I don't know.
But you do see a lot of the, I think in the 80s, you saw a lot of about the Japanese culture. So, like, the Yakuza, the Harakiri, like, the soldiers killing themselves. Like, that one scene early on where...
Tia Carrera's character ends up being disgraced. And so she attempts to commit Harakiri.
And then one of Carrie's soldiers...
Seppuku is what it's called.
Yeah.
Right,
so... In the police precinct, remember when the guy snaps his whole neck.
Yeah, that was nuts.
That is freaky. So
crazy. Like... And it's funny because Brandon's like, "Hey, what's that guy supposed to be doing?" You know, he's performing some ritual. And next thing he looks, Dolph Lundgren looks over, and he's like, "Ah, shit!" Runs out and like gets in there just as the guy twists his own neck and snaps it.
Yeah. The one thing I was noticing in a lot of the films is you do see a lot of the Asian actors that have been in numerous other films. Like, I'm just trying to pick out some of the names, some of the actors. Like, there's one guy. I gotta find what actor that is. He actually has a mustache in all of his films. He always plays the typical. He looks like Mongolian.
Yes,
he plays. He's, do you remember that name?
He's
from Die Hard?
No.
Yeah, I think this is the guy we've talked about him on.
Is he in Chocolate Bar?
I don't know. I just know he typically has longer hair and he has like the mustache.
Yeah, if it's the guy I'm thinking of, we call him Asian John Oates because he looks like John Oates from Hall & Oates.
I'm just looking at the Internet Movie Database.
Yes.
Lethal Weapon was another one he was in. If it's the same guy I'm thinking of.
No, it is definitely, because I know we were talking about him on other shows. I'm just trying to find him.
That guy was... I gotta see this movie his now. Name I love is, that guy.
His name is actually something I didn't think he... You know how you kind of see someone like, oh, that looks like a Bob or a Tom or whatever?
Yeah.
And yeah, his name was like something I didn't think it was going to be. It doesn't... I don't believe it sounded too Asian in a sense.
Bob Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Red.
I love that guy, though.
See, I'd have to go to the full... I apologize. I can't find it, but I'm sure we'll find it. But
do a search of Die Hard. It's probably just right on there.
So, anyway, he's actually in Showdown in Little Tokyo, and he's also in Rapid Fire. In Rapid Fire, he's in the scene...
I didn't pick that up.
Yeah, he's in the scene where Brandon comes down the stairs... Well, Brandon's down in the factory, and he comes down... He goes to go up the stairs. This guy's coming down the stairs, and Brandon steps back.
Okay.
They get into a knife kind of battle. And... That was, like, gotta be one of my favorite scenes in that film. But we'll talk about that.
That's gonna be our next film on the list. In regards to Showdown in Tokyo, I have to admit, I usually watch that movie. This is probably about my seventh time that I've watched it over the 25 years, give or take. It's probably a movie I'd watch again. Number one, I mean, it's the Japanese culture, so I like that. But no, I would definitely, as far as giving it ratings... Story-wise, it's watchable, but I'd probably give it, like, say, a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I think most people were giving it basically that as well, that I saw online with it. And I would give it something like that, too. It was really, you know, your typical B-movie, lots of cliches. Like, you have crazy scenes like Dolph Lundgren, like, actually squatting down, picking up a car, and pushing it over, and it's like, okay, I'm on roids or something, I don't know, but I know he's a big guy in that film, he acts very fit, but, yeah, you get some crazy scenes like that happening, when he's pressing cars, And he tips it over, I think, and it explodes. And I'm like, okay, you know, how do cars explode when they're tipped over? But
movie magic.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of the transitional people are stunt people. So, like, James Liu is one of the main guys in Showdown Little Tokyo. He does a lot of the stunts. And he's just kind of like a B player. You see him, and he's just like one of the guys that Brandon will fight, or Dolph Lundgren will fight, or they're part of the Yakuza gang, that sort of thing. And Jeff Amada, who's actually credited for a lot of the stunts with Brandon in Rapid Fire as well. He trained Brandon along with Dan Inosanto, who was Bruce Lee's right-hand man, and took over the Jeet Kune Do throne, I guess you could say. He's in the hierarchy. He's the head fellow that will lead and pretty much run the Jeet Kune Do Society at this point in time. So.
Well, if it shows, if I found the right one, it shows, I guess, he was raised in Inglewood, California, where he began studying martial arts at 15. And then I guess he started working while in college as a movie extra. So he's part of the members of the Screen Actors Guild. But overall, I definitely enjoy the movie, but right now we're going to go for a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk about our next movie, Rapid Fire. See you guys in a bit.
Stay tuned, loyal listeners. There's more We Got the Geek still to come.
Kristen Hunter is a Canadian artist specializing in polymer clay creations. Kristen is a geek at heart, and most of her creations are nerd-themed. She makes everything from Captain America earrings to video game-inspired necklaces and everything else in between. Check out Kristen's amazing work at www.wasabeads.com or visit her Facebook group, Wasabeads Custom Creations.
Welcome back to the Martial Arts Edition. You got myself, Ryan, and my co-host, Jody.
Hiya, doing.
That's throw that clever, in there, sir. Our next movie on tonight's topic is Rapid Fire. Again, a Brandon Lee movie. This one is from 1992. Again, we're going back over 20 years ago, give or take. This one, description is about a student. Brandon Lee's character witnesses a killing and finds himself caught between two feuding drug lords. And is portrayed, again, I think it's almost kind of cliche, but is betrayed by a federal agent and then is being protected by a fellow cop, played by Powers Booth. The director of this movie is Dwight H. Little. Some of the other films he's done in, again, you guys have probably well heard of, Halloween 4, 1988, Marked for Death, 1990, Steven Scull.
Yeah, movie. Steven Scull, yeah.
Some TV shows he's done recently is The Practice, Bones, and Nikita. The writers for the film are Cindy Searle for the story and an Alan B. McElroy also for the story. And again, stars Brandon Lee, Powers Booth, and Nick Mancuso.
Yeah, that film actually, Rapid Fire, was written for specifically Brandon Lee.
Yeah, you can tell for sure that one. This one improved a little bit because obviously Brandon Lee's character has a little more dialogue because it's for his character. You can sort of see the improvement because you got to figure there's almost a year or 2 years apart, right? You got to figure when movies come out, the year or two before it actually gets released, right?
Yeah.
But just seeing, number one, seeing how young some of the actors are, like Powers Booth, Nick Mancuso, who've been acting up until this day, right? I enjoyed this movie.
This was definitely a big improvement.
Oh, gotcha.
From the last film,
yeah.
Showdown. So, basically, Brandon plays Jake Lowe. And an interesting fact is that his father played Billy Lowe in Game of Death from 1978 when that came out as well. So there's that, you know, name thing as well going on. So always like little tie-ins and set, you know, into each other. So, yeah, he plays Jake Lowe. And like you were saying, you have Mr. Serrano, who's basically the main villain. He's kind of like an Italian mobster.
Yep.
And he's... wants to take over, I think his name's Tao, his turf, and he's in the heroin business. That's the one with the heroin business.
He also is an actor that's been, it's pronounced like, or spelled T-Z-I-M-A. That's the character that I think he goes to try to get a favor from him. I don't know where he is, if it's in Cambodia
They're in, I thought it was Thailand myself.
It could have been. Could have been. It could have been Cambodia. But basically, he's the mobster. So that's
yeah. He goes to
Cruzos goes there to ask for a favor, and he pretty much gets told no. Yeah.
In a nice way, he takes the there's a couple of guys. I love that scene because there's he tells his one bodyguard just hang out in the back and watch these guys. So he goes out, and there's two guys with staffs, which are about 6 feet long, and they're duking it out. And he takes the one staff and goes out, and he literally one guy kicks these two guys' asses, right? Then he comes back over. And he was kind of threateningly saying to him, stay off my turf. You don't, you're way over your head, man.
Yeah.
So he, Mr. Serrano spits on the ground and he takes the staff and spears it literally in the ground. And he, in Sicilian, tells him to, hit the road. I think it ends up being some of the lines of the Sicilian proverb was, you can't take what isn't yours.
Yeah.
So I just love that scene. And well, from there, it kind of sets the tone of the whole film and what's going to happen.
Well, he's pretty much telling Nick Mancuso's characters, if don't come at me if you can't sort of take it over, right?
Right, so, exactly. He's like I say, you can't take what's not yours because he's like, I know we were buddies growing up because I think they were childhood friends.
Well, I think they just helped each other.
They helped each other.
Get his product on the street, right?
Right. So he wants more because he's struggling, so he wants to take over more. And he starts chewing off more than he can handle in this case.
No, definitely. Well, this is where we sort of fast forward to, I guess, there's an art gallery where Brandon Lee's character gets invited to under the premise that a girl asks him out on a date, but you find out because of who his father was in the show, in the movie,
right.
He was a soldier for the Chinese army.
Yeah.
But I guess he died protecting the girl.
Square.
Yeah. So, because I guess it was like a rally to raise funds for that event. But what we see is one of the guy that, I don't know how to pronounce his name, I apologize, the TZIMA character, one of his soldiers is at this art gallery who's holding it. And then you meet Nick Mancuso's character in the office where he ends up shooting.
That's Mr. Serrano.
Mr. Serrano.
We'll just refer to him as Mr. Serrano.
He ends up shooting one of the soldiers there. And then I guess Brandon Lee's character, or was it?
Yeah, he ends up killing Jake Mr. Tao's right-hand man, I guess.
But Jake sees this.
Right.
And then he ends up going. He actually sees Serrano shoot him.
Yeah. So they're all like, get that kid!
Exactly. And then he gets put into productive custody by the FBI.
Well, that's going back a sec. That's actually a great fight scene, that kind of warehouse scenario.
Like when he takes off on the bike.
Yeah, this is kind of like the start of, you can see some of the JKD kick in. Because, I love it. The guy's coming downstairs. Now, you must have shins of iron because he just blasts through those pegs. That are holding up the railing, they're not pegs, I know, but he just cuts through that like they were butter and trips, basically smashes the guy's shins, the guy falls down, and they kind of get into it. But a lot of that fight scene is awesome. It's pure JKD or Jeet Kune Do, which is Bruce's art, which he kind of started, and more or less in a case of his own way of expressing himself, and that's why he did it. So if I was to learn Jeet Kune Do today, it's going to be different from what you learn it because we have different builds, different weights and heights, and I may have longer arms, you may have longer legs, different things that play into it. So everyone's got different strengths and weaknesses. So in this case, it was a fundraiser fight scene that I love because he does Jeet Tech stuff, which for those that don't know is you intercept someone before they actually strike you, so you would intercept that,
so defensive
in a way. Yeah, so he was doing a lot of trapping, so he couldn't throw any punches and that sort of thing at him. One of the great scenes, which segues is into a connected part of his father, was the one guy he's duking with, he ends up getting him in a headlock and from behind starts heel kicking him in the face in this headlock. And I believe that's in one of Bruce's films. I can't remember exactly which one off the top of my head, but he kind of did that. And when I saw that, Like, Rapid Fire was a film I actually originally saw in the theaters, and I was so stoked to see it. At the time, I was taking karate. So me and my buddy went down into Hamilton, and we saw it at one of the cinemas there. And we loved it. We came out of there just, you know, hooping and hollering like everybody, and you're throwing kicks and karate stuff. You know, it was great. And I ended up, I think, seeing it about three times that year.
Wow.
I was so loving that film. Now, I look at the fight scenes nowadays, and they still stand up, but like I say, still not, if they probably did them a little quicker, might have, and like you say, with the sound effects, a little bit more realistic would have been, probably stand up to today's standards, but
yeah,
it was, that was one of my favorite scenes in that case.
Well, just that's the first movie I think I noticed that the sound effects were like you could tell that it was added.
Bam, pow, pop.
Yeah, that's all I was missing is the Batman.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the movie, and it was funny just seeing actors again, like your common actor, like, so Powers Booth, Nick Mancuso. We're just like the Nick Mancuso was the Antonio Serrano's character, so he was the.
And the. Villain we just found out was El Leon.
There was actually two villains in this one. So there was that.
Well, the one that he comes down the stairs. That's
El Leon. You're talking about like one of the henchmen.
Yeah.
Yes, who's also been in.
Because Jay likes to call
films.
Him the
Asian
John Oates. Best way to describe it.
Actually, now that you mentioned
it. He does
it,
look
yeah.
like him.
Thing is, I can't search Internet Movie Database for the Asian John Oates.
Al Leong.
As Al Leong, yes. I was taking a moment, like, what are you talking about? Okay, wait a second. 5 second memory here. I enjoyed the movie. It's one of those things where I think this is probably my third time watching it ever since it's been out. I mean,
right.
I own the movie, but
yes. Yeah, I own it too as well.
But definitely the fact that this movie was written for him, you can sort of tell that he had more chance. Just for his acting, you can still tell it was a little, not say robotic, but just, I don't know how to explain it. Just, you can tell that.
I don't know. I don't know where you're going on that one. Cause,
I don't know. When we talk about our next movie, like The Crow, between that and that, I think The Crow was hands down just.
The Crow's a whole different story, too.
No,
well.
I guess maybe that might be it, too.
This
right?
one's a little bit, has a little bit of cliche, like you say. So basically. Now, Jake Lowe sees the guy get shot. He ends up being on their hit list, so they take him into
protective custody. But then he gets betrayed by the FBI.
And
agent.
Kind of the same character he plays a little bit. He's a little wisecracker, you know, back-talking people and that sort of thing. And they take him, they put him in a safe house in Chicago now. They've moved him. So he's there, and next great fight scene that comes up. Because you can kind of see like how they set things up for all the fight scenes.
Well, out of the three
great
agents there was the two that were
Two were crooked.
Yeah.
And one of them, they actually, you know, put their silencers on and they shoot him. And Jake Lowe's actually asking at that point in time, so who else is testifying?
Yeah.
And they're like, no one but you, and they kill the other guy, and that was one of my favorite scenes, because he's like, hey, what do you guys got to eat here? And he's Brandon Lee's in the kitchen, he's looking for food, and he's like, great, Pop-Tarts. Looks around again, oh, what, more Pop-Tarts? Like, I guess I'm going to have Pop-Tarts. So it's kind of funny, and then they actually ends up utilizing a lot of his surroundings in this fight scene. The fridge, the freezer door slams out in some guy's face. And then one guy comes in to the hallway and they're going to kill him. And he's like, oh crap, you know. And that's funny because at that point, after they shoot the cop, he looks at the camera, deadpan, and says, oh shit. And then he leans up against the wall and they start circling him. One comes in through the kitchen, the other comes out through the hallway. And he slams the door in the one guy's face, right, as he's trying to come in from the hallway. And then the other guy, he's duking with and that sort of thing. But it's funny because the other guy, he slams him with the freezer door. The other guy kind of come back in the door. Brandon kicks it, slams the door back into his face. And then they start shooting. He kind of dunks down into the kitchen counters. They get blasted and stuff like that. And he finds his way, I believe, into the...
it's one of the windows in the fire escape.
Goes into the bathroom is where it is. And the guy comes through, and he ends up trying to kick through, because I don't know why, but there was this giant grate on the window, which leads to the fire escape, as you mentioned. So he's trying to kick his way through, and he grabs the, it was like a pitchfork for like barbecue.
Yeah, I remember
the guy,
that.
That guy comes through.
He ends up stabbing him.
And he ends up stabbing him. Now, the great scene with that is his facial expression was almost deadpan to his father, Bruce, in Enter the Dragon when he jumps down and he breaks the one fellow's the neck. And he just has that whole kind of look of, like, regret, but I had to do it to survive, and but I don't want to take this guy's life. It's just a lot of emotion right in that one scene. And then I think he ends up kicking the body through, which is just enough weight, I think, to, you know, knock the gate off, and he gets down the fire escape.
And, yeah. Well, and that's when he runs into the other the actress, cop.
Right.
She, I mean, he has this gun with the silencer.
That was the first point that his love interest, so to speak, he runs into and takes her hostage.
Well, I just thought it was funny that you have the other cop pulling up, seeing this other cop pull a gun, and the other cop's telling her to put the gun down.
Right.
It's like, I'm a cop.
Right.
And that's when he takes the time to take off because the
and then he they the get shot at agent. By the corrupt guy. And then they're like, what are you doing shooting him for? You know? And he gets away. Yeah.
But like you said, like most sort of your typical movies, there's a heroine type of thing where he sort of meets up, like the female cop, right? Like he ends up being in the apartment with her.
Yeah, then that '90s movie, the music comes on as they make love.
Yeah, exactly.
That was actually funny because that was Neil Sean's, his band Hardline at the time, which is Neil Sean's, I think he's the guitarist from Journey.
Mm-hmm.
So he ends up, I ended up buying that album. That's... Oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying that. But I did because of the, like that whole, they had two songs in the film and it just reminds me of Rapid Fire, I guess. I don't know.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So there's my, moment.
One of the scenes that I kind of also enjoyed was, so the Powers Booth character convinces Brandon Lee's character to kind of go into Serrano's den, what have Vipers, at the restaurant.
Right.
Whereas the other corrupt, the main corrupt agent that set all that up.
Yeah, he's been after this guy for quite some time.
So they sent him in, and they were supposed to be like a keyword. And unfortunately, the mic
the keyword, yeah, the keyword was, nice doing business
and
with you.
And he kept saying it. It's like, wow, that isn't giving yourself away that something's up.
Yeah, exactly.
So he keeps saying that, and then Serrano ends up shooting him.
Yeah, Serrano ends up saying, nice doing business with you, Tom. He's like, hey, Frank, yeah. And he says, why'd you say you didn't want it for free? I think he was like, he said he'd get some money from him for the first thing.
Yeah.
And then he ends up saying, you know what? No, you're going to do this for free. And then he realizes, okay, something's going on with this guy. Obviously, he's on the take. So he ends up looking at him. He's sweating like a pig. And from there, he ends up, just want to get it alive. And then he ends up being shot shortly after that. And I think that's the second guy that Mr. Serrano kills. Because he hasn't, killed anyone, in a long time.
Yeah.
Since he came up the ranks, I believe. So this is kind of like a big moment, too. So they got him with, murder. Because Brandon sees that as well.
Yeah.
And like you say, that's the third great big scene that they go down with in that one. That's got a whole whack of stuff going on. Guns firing off. Brandon's trying to get out alive. Cops are shooting from the outside in. So you're avoiding bullets. I think he ends up smacking Serrano in the face, which is awesome. And then he tries to get out. Exit doors, shut. And then I think a guy's going to take a shot at him. Sniper on the roof gets the gangster that's going to shoot Brandon. And then then he jumps down. He fights that big bodyguard. Remember that? And then. He gets thrown around like a rag doll. Tony Longo,
the big bodyguard there.
He gets thrown around like a rag doll, thrown across the bar. There's some great moments in there, and a lot of JKD stuff happening there. Double sticks. He picks up two legs. Does this fight scene there?
Well, there's definitely a lot of good fighting scenes. Yeah. Just the choreography.
Yeah, the choreography was amazing.
Especially if they had any. Yeah. After movies, but we'll be back. We'll just going for a break. We'll see you guys in a bit.
Hold on, true believers. There's more We Got the Geek after these words. Face front, true believers. John Bulmer is an independent artist and illustrator. He has contributed to several indie comics published by Alterna Comics and more, and is able to draw in many styles and genres. John also does commission work in sizes ranging from 3 by 5 inches to 11 by 17 inches and even larger. Add some original art to your personal collection or surprise someone with a drawing just for them. Check out his work at drawnbyjohn.com and his Facebook group, Drawn by John, The Art of John J.C. Bulmer.
And welcome back, guys. You got myself, Ryan, and Jody with We Got the Geek Martial Arts Edition. First of many. Actually had fun actually discussing this with you, Jody, at our day job, and just finally get this to do this, our first episode tonight. We were just talking about just the fighting technique styles before we went to our commercial.
Yeah, we were talking about kind of took the break there. It was the third fight scene in Rapid Fire.
Yeah, it was in the
bar restaurant. Yep. Yeah. And a lot of great stuff going down there. Brandon was throwing in the Jeet Kune Do stuff. So a lot of it, you see like some elbow work. He comes in with the distractions. It definitely comes from the Filipino arts as well. Muay Thai, actually. In that case, it's from Thailand. So there's that. He had some great scenes, like he flips over the guy with the shotgun, mm-hmm. blasts the guy. When he jumps off the main level, jumps down, he ends up doing the big fight scene, I said, with the big guy. He gets thrown around like a rag doll and ends up... the only way he could crush him was he took out the last pillar of the top level, which ended up crashing him. But when he jumps, he breaks one of the tables, so he ends up grabbing a couple of table legs and going into using double stick methods against these guys. Mm-hmm. And he does like a distraction technique. He throws the one... one dude had... I slowed it down and I looked at it again. Then one guy actually had a baseball bat, which I didn't notice at first. I thought it was a table leg he had, but he ended up... this one villain had... or the gangster guy had a baseball bat. So he ends up somehow getting that and throws it up in the air, and with the table leg, he whacks the guy. Yep. One. So he's like, ha! Boom! And it takes him out. So that was kind of neat. I like that. He does some more techniques in that with clearing punches, and he ends up hitting the guy down low, goes up high, so he kind of hits him in the leg, mm-hmm. and then he kind of goes up high. And I think he ends up breaking the guy's arm with the table leg. And so that was kind of a great kind of collie double stick moment in that case, where it kind of showcased those different things that Jeet Kune Do artists use. They take a bit of Muay Thai, in that case the elbows, and then the Kali, which is the Filipino arts, which is very bladed. They come from a bladed weapon, and then they ended up, because obviously we're going to train this stuff, we're going to be killing people, so they end up kind of sterilizing it in a way and just using sticks. So now when you train, you're always training with sticks per se. And going from that, and then they just easily can transition into a knife, a sword, pool cue, whatever you have, right? So that was that was interesting to see that fight scene and him getting out. I think when he fights the one guy, he does take the guys have some guns. He kind of tangles them up, and he ends up shooting in the front windows. There's a bunch of gangsters, and they're firing at the cops outside. Well, one of the guys has like a double barrel kind of machine gun. He's just gatling it, just bang, 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 going away, and blowing away things outside. Well, Brandon ends up shooting the guy in the back with this gangster's gun, as he's tangling with these guys. He ends up shooting him. That fellow there was actually Jean LaBelle.
Okay.
Now, to those that don't know, Jean LaBelle is actually a judo master who actually trained with Bruce and was very good friends of the family. So there's that connection as well. So Jean LaBelle also is a stuntman. He's been in tons of films, but you just don't realize it, obviously, because he's a stuntman. But he's credited with a lot of stunts and that sort of thing. So in this film, he was playing like one of the background gangster guys and ends up being killed. And I thought that was kind of cool to kind of see him, you know, in it as well. So that was the last, I think that was one of the last big fight scenes. And then they take Serrano out. He ends up actually, yeah, he ends up smashing Serrano in the nose.
Yep.
He elbows him in the nose. And then kind of quotes him back the whole, hey, sweating like a pig, and all he wants to do is get out. And ends up, yeah, beating him up pretty good and takes him, drags him outside and drops him in front of Nick Mancuso's cop character. So he ends up taking him away, putting him in jail.
Yeah.
And that's when Mr. El Leong, Mr. John Oates, Asian style,
John Oates, yeah.
He ends up, throwing knives and spear shurikens, which is ninja stars, at him through the jail. He pretends he's a cop and ends up killing him. So that gets rid of Serrano. So.
And then that's when you move on to the other boss, the final boss.
That's the final boss, yeah. Mr. I think his name's Tao or something like that. Can't recall
what,
exactly.
TZI.
TZI?
Yeah. M-A.
Okay.
For the last name. Well, that's when you sort of move on, transition, where Brandon and Lee's character goes into the wash and dryer, like the building where they're hiding the heroin.
Right. In the dryer sheet.
In the dryer sheets.
Yeah.
And then you have a fight scene there, and I believe that's where the movie ends.
Yeah, that was a big fight scene there. That would be the final one. That's when he meets El Leong, and he battles him. And there's some great knife work there. And he ends up, he does like a Superman punch off the fence. He spins around, comes back at him, punches him in the face. Brandon does. And they go on the ground. They do have a big battle, that type of thing. So you see, I think they go into some like leg locks as well, if I'm not mistaken, if that's the scene. And some knife disarms and whatnot. And he ends up getting bladed in the end of it. That's how that guy gets killed.
Yeah.
That reminded me. Yeah, the one scene, there was a lot of trapping. So when he comes in with the blade, Brandon actually... No, he doesn't have the blade in this point. He ends up trapping a lot of punches and that sort of thing. So there's this, like, you know, pocking and mixing it up with his hands and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that was pure Jeet Kune Do there. And Bruce actually kind of shows that in the very intro of Enter the Dragon, when he's against his buddy Bolo Young. Not Bolo Young, but what's his name? Anyway, he fights the big guy.
Can't
remember his name right off the top of my head, but that was a link there as well. So, and then he ends up with the actual villain. What's his name? Sai Mei?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. It was TZI and then M-A.
Yeah. He ends up battling him in the railway, just on the platform. There was that was where one of the key knife segments comes in. He disarms it, takes away the knife. They end up battling, falls onto the rails, and he's got the kind of the poles that they use, and he ends up beating the crap out of Brand with those for a bit.
And if I recall, he gets shocked.
He gets electrocuted. Yeah.
And then
one pole goes on one rail, the other pole goes on another rail, and then he gets fried because the train goes by.
Brandon Lee's character gets out.
Not only does he get fried,
he gets hit.
He also gets knocked into the by the train. So they made sure he was dead and good.
Like, this is a film I would definitely want. I mean, I'd have to say now 10 times, because I do like the movies. Mm-hmm. It's entertaining. And I think you mentioned earlier that, unfortunately, if Brandon Lee didn't pass away, they were thinking about doing Rapid Fire 2. So it would have been interesting to see that how that franchise would have turned into. But honestly, I'd probably give it a good 7 out of 10 stars.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was better. It had its kind of, you know, moments and that sort of thing. But definitely a lot more A-rated than B in this case.
Yeah, so oh no, for
I
sure.
I agree with that, yeah. That's what I was thinking of B.
But our next film, which I've been wanting, I haven't talked to our producer, Jace, too, about this. I think it was reviewed a few months ago on one of our other shows. But I'm like, we have to review it again, especially as part of our martial arts, is The Crow. I'm sure all of you have heard it. I think, Jay, you said you watched it just a few months ago.
Yeah, for the very first time. 20 years later.
This one is based off, it was actually a comic.
Yeah, by James O'Barr.
By James O'Barr, who wrote it, I guess, with the way of dealing with the death of his girlfriend. The movie, 1994, I still can't believe it's been that far gone. I've probably gone through, like, two copies, two VHSs at the time. Now, wow. It was on DVD. Just when you watch something so much, you just wear it
out. Yeah, definitely with tape, for sure.
Unfortunately, I think there was probably insert inappropriate joke there, but this movie, 1994, the synopsis is, a man's brutally murdered, comes back to life as the undead avenger of himself and his fiancée's murder. The director of this is by a name of Alex Proyas. I'm not too sure if I pronounced
that. Yeah, I think that's close.
Is that what it is? Okay. Yeah. He's directed over 18 movies.
Dark City, I believe, is one of them.
Just seeing here. He's actually still directing. Most recent, or most recently, I would say 2004, iRobot.
Oh, that was you're right.
Dark City was one of it. That was 1998.
I think that was his next. Was it, according to that, is that his next one after The Crow?
Well, it shows here The Crow was 1994, and then he did a short film, Book of Dreams, Welcome to Crateland, and then a video, Best of Sting, and then Dark City, 1994.
Yeah, so really his next film was Dark City.
Was the next film.
Okay, that's what I thought. Which wasn't too bad.
And I mean, iRobot was pretty good.
Yeah, I didn't mind that one.
And again, the story was written by James O'Barr. Who did both the book series and the comic strip.
Yeah.
And then David J. Shaw, or Sko, I apologize if I didn't pronounce it, did the screenplay.
Okay.
Now, the movie stars Brandon Lee, Rochelle Davis, Ernie Hudson, amongst a few others. I haven't seen much of Rochelle Davis. She's the one that played Sarah.
Oh, yeah, the little kid.
The little kid. Yeah. I don't think she's acted that much. Ernie Hudson, I mean...
He's the cop.
He's the cop.
Yeah, he's
still
really
in the
good.
Game. I still remember from Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah.
Again, we'll save those two movies for another monster review. But you have... So Brandon Lee plays the character, the main character, Eric Draven.
Yeah, he's the rock guitarist, musician, whatever you want to say.
In fact, spoilers for those that haven't seen it, him and his fiance get murdered on, I think...
Halloween.
Halloween the night before the Devil's Night, I
Devil's
think.
Night, yep.
And they were supposed to get married on Halloween. They get killed by thugs, basically trying to clear tenants out of a building. And Eric's, or Brendan Lee's fiance, was starting a petition to say, no, we're standing up type of thing. Unfortunately, that part and parcel got to why she ended up dying.
Right.
But I just...
That's interesting, because that scene when they're evicting him and the whole that was a really violent scene. That
definitely
was like, the scene actually where Brandon in real life dies. That was where the incident happened when he got shot.
You're right. That's the one where they were doing. And the thing is, though, when they do movies, obviously they don't do things in chronological order.
Right.
They do things kind of all over the place. Yeah. That's okay.
That shows up earlier in the film and
it.
It was kind of interesting that.
Well, I do know, unfortunately, that was
like his final scene.
This was his final scene and his final movie. In fact, I remember watching something on A&E where they actually had to do some video editing. So him walking down the aisle, like alleyway, was old footage of like a previous recording. So they had to sort of change it.
Yeah, they did like CGI on the faces, and it was like two guys that were stunt doubles for Brandon at the time, and they filled in doing the extra parts that were required, and then I think they CGI'd Brandon's face on as far as I know. So
yeah, well,
but it's interesting how they did it, because if you watch it, it's like, you know,
well,
it's really
like
well
now.
Done.
Well, you got to look at now with the techniques. Just
back
then, it was still early 90s where the CGI wasn't.
That was pretty impressive.
It's so impressive for what they had to work with.
Right? I couldn't see any like little gaps or anything that like. Oh,
see,
that's
I can pick it up now. Though.
You can if you really pay attention. Yeah. Yes.
But the part that led to his death, unfortunately, I think was a loaded. Something was wrong with the actual gun, the stun gun.
Yeah, there was all the, you know, the people were like, oh, it's the, you know, the Lee curse and this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, yeah, if you believe that, fine. But, you know, I tend to lean towards the side of, you know, that it now. How it came about, who knows? But there was troubles on the set from the get go. I remember reading in the paper there was like carpenters that were having nail guns. You know, they nailed themselves, or just weird, a lot of weird things that were going on at the time. They were saying, "Oh, that's the set's haunted," and that sort of thing. And so it wasn't like, oh, this one thing happened. There was like a series of events where a lot of things were going wrong. And then what happened was they did a close-up shot of the gun and putting in the bullets, I believe. And then what happened was they didn't, the person that was handling the guns didn't clear the chamber properly. And then they put in the blanks, and which was just like, that has like gunpowder and paper, and really no one would get hurt, but a piece of the original bullet that went in stayed. So when they put it the blanks in, and they ended up firing it. Now the other thing was, you're not supposed to fire directly on the person you're going to shoot. In film, you're supposed to go off target.
Yeah.
So what happened was he ended up staying on target for whatever reason, and when he fired, obviously it was like a real bullet, right? Because the gunpowder kicked it out, and the metal was in there, so it ended up going through his abdomen and almost severing his spine.
That's
so,
what I read, unfortunately.
Right. So he ended up being rushed to the hospital. They did emergency surgery to stop the bleeding, and obviously they weren't successful and was pronounced dead. I think it was like 1:30 or in the morning or something.
That's afternoon,
like that.
It showed.
Afternoon, sorry. Yeah, that's it. So, yeah, and unfortunately, you know, we lost a great actor and a great, you know, martial artist. And,
well, just the potential. Like, we were talking about this at our day job, just seeing what kind of movies would he be doing now? Would he have been doing the other Crows that I think they're trying to attempt to capture the same?
Yeah, because they did so well with it. They were like, hey, you know, this could be like a franchise, like the Batman franchise, right? And you could have had like some really good stories after that.
I mean, I know they are doing a remake of The Crow, so it'd be interesting to see the actor that they get if it does well. Not like, oh, it's the other two I wouldn't even consider.
They hired a guy. I don't remember who it is.
Yeah.
I know they were trying to get Tom Hiddleston, who played Loki in The Avengers.
Okay.
But he's not doing it.
Yeah. Well, as long as they do it justice, it does suck that the scene, because like you were saying, it was a pretty graphic scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot of...
But the actors there...
Rape going on and some
was,
serious stuff.
Like, one of the characters, T-Bird, played by David Patrick Kelly.
Fire it up. Fire
Skank.
It up.
I love how they make references. Like, do none of them have adult names, if you remember the scene between Ernie Hudson's character and the other detective that didn't like him. Tintin, Lawrence Mason. Skank and Angel David, Fun Boy, Michael Massey, and Tony Todd.
Tony Todd, Candyman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So some classic 80s, early 90s characters that you'll probably remember in from other movies.
And David Patrick Kelly. Okay, so he played T-Bird.
He's the main...
Yeah, he was one of the main villains. And if you want to go back in time to... my all-time favorite movie, it's a cult classic as well, kind of like The Crow, The Warriors. He played the main...
in the 70s.
The main villain. And I can't recall his name off the top of my head, but he's the one that, at the end, he has the beer bottles, and he's clanking them, and he says, "Warriors, come out and play."
He played Luther. And
Luther,
that shows it's his first movie from what Internet Movie Database is showing.
And
79, that's a classic movie. That's one of the first movies I think you let me borrow.
I love that movie so much. And they were supposed to actually redo this, and from what this is way back, I heard they were supposed to have real gangs they were trying to get, and some gang members actually involved in it. And kind of make it a little bit more realistic. Storyline, I think it was supposed to be L.A. instead of, I think this is in the Bronx.
New York? Yeah, like this one's in
New York. Yeah. And the director is?
It shows here as a Walter Hill.
Right.
48 Hours.
Yep.
That's another movie.
That's another
another 48
another
Hours.
Another cop.
Yeah. So just imagine that, just seeing the different directors, seeing the other classic cult movies that they've directed.
Yeah.
This, like I said, like, this is one of my all-time favorites.
There's
like,
a lot of good actors in this, like, one, for sure.
Well, you recognize him. I mean, then you also have the main villain, Michael Wincott, who has that distinct...
Yes.
First movie I've ever seen him in was 1991 Prince of Thieves with...
Okay.
The Robin Hood film, where...
Oh, which one was he?
He played... oh my god, he played the cousin to...
Oh, yeah!
He was a spoon, because it hurts more.
I love that guy.
Oh, okay.
But he played the cousin to that guy.
Nice.
So... And then you have Bai Ling, who's supposed to be the half-sister to Michael Wincott.
Yeah, that whole scene was just kind of kinky weird.
She had a thing about eyes.
Yeah, she loved eyes. See, they were windows to the soul.
I like the fact that it was sort of like gothic.
Yes.
I've not read the comic, so I'm hoping maybe on one of our comic
editions. The comic, actually, I did end up buying that, and it was very close to the film. I was very impressed with it.
Nice.
Yeah, so, and the artwork's really cool in it, too.
Well, like you said, they had Fun Boy, they had a T-Bird, Tom-Tom, Tintin, so, I mean, actually, pretty much...
Skank. He's my fave.
They don't have Skank, though, in this one, just based off what I'm seeing online. But I'd love to get my hands on this, just to see how close... Because you know how sometimes comics...
Yeah, there are some small changes, I think, but...
Well, you kind of have to.
It was pretty much dead on to the book.
And that's what I like about... comics and TV shows or movies is that they don't go necessarily always go by the book, because it's always nice to see just a different spin, a different take.
Right, yeah.
But overall, with The Crow, I couldn't even count how many times I've
even
watched
his costume
movie.
They got it pretty much dead on.
Well,
I was very impressed with it. From the rips in it,
you talk about other movies, you know, that they continued.
Big boots to...
They tried doing the same thing in the second movie and in the third movie. And then obviously there's a TV show, The Crow, and the actor that played him, I think, was almost dead on. He's been in...
Oh.
It was a TV show, though. Like, how long can you really go with a TV show,
yeah,
right, before... Because once you save...
The storyline is pretty much in one movie.
Exactly.
Really.
It's like you save your fiancé, you save that person, but then what? You just don't continue living. You kind of go back to the grave type of thing, right?
Yeah.
But this movie, I don't know. I couldn't count how many times I've watched this. It's...
Yeah, like you say, it's a cult classic, and
yeah,
I've seen it... But, you know, a dozen
well,
times.
Like I told you earlier, I went through two VHSs back in the day. Like, I mean, just because you watch it so much.
Now you're just wearing out the DVD.
Yeah, exactly. in fact, I actually have the collector's series. I have the regular one, and I have made a mistake. I bought a French one, but I'm not going to sell it. It's okay.
So what did you like most in that film? Like, what are some of the scenes that really captured your attention?
Well, what I liked about the film is just how dark it was. Like, it was kind of... They didn't necessarily specify what
yes.
year it was. It was in the future.
Right.
Not future, but just sometime down the road. I just like the theme
was
of it.
There
the
was
overall...
very little sunshine. It was always
exactly,
rainy.
Exactly. Like, it was all dark.
Or night.
Mean, the rain actually just reminded me of the soundtrack for the film.
Yes. Yeah.
Was actually
which is
really
good.
Well done. I actually just loaded that onto my iPhone.
Cool Stone Temple Pilots.
Yeah. Just all the early 90s. The soundtrack's amazing.
I think
for
The
it.
Cure was on there.
Yeah.
Stone Temple Pilots.
Actually, let's see what the interweaves has for that one. Actually, the soundtrack, I have the CD. I actually had the tape when we all used to have tapes. Imagine
yeah.
that. That's so many years ago.
Yeah. But yeah, for me...
I just like the fact that, okay, I know it's not a in-your-face martial arts film like our other two films.
No.
It still had that in his fighting scenes.
Yep.
My favorite one is the one when he's in the bed with Darla, and not him, but he comes again.
Right.
And he
draws
him.
The vein,
the heroin
out of
her
veins.
Vein, but I like when he's in the bed.
Yes.
And he's like, he puts his hand right up to the gun, like
yeah.
the handgun, and then he blows it. But the other guy's so high, he's like, wow. It's like, ah. And then he holds it up, and it heals up.
Yeah.
Again, the special effects back then, you can sort of tell. And the guy's like, oh, my God. And
still,
it
wasn't that bad. For
no,
that.
It wasn't.
Then,
no,
right?
True. But I like that scene. I like the knife scene.
Isn't that? I think that scene. I'm not too sure. Was that the one where he's like, "You got me, bang dead right" or something like that? I think that was his tagline.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that was funny because then he blows the hole in his hand. And he's looking through his hand.
Yeah, because that's
at
the
guy.
Fun
and the guy's
boy.
All yeah. Fun boy's all like tripping, so he's finding this absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. Like, I like Tintin's the way he died. Like, just...
With the... Is that the knives?
That's the knives.
I love that scene.
He's just, like, a crack-addicted person.
Yeah.
And then goes after him.
Yeah, he throws the knives at him, Brandon catches him, and then fires him back at him.
I didn't think too much of Skank's death. Like, all it was is, like, he punches him a few times and throws him out the window. Like...
Yeah. Skank's line, my favorite one, is when he's with the big bosses.
Yeah.
Top Dollar and those guys, and he's like... He goes, how do you feel, Skank? He goes, I feel like a little worm on a big hook. I just love that. That was just absolutely hilarious. I'm like, yeah.
Fire it up.
Fire it up.
And they're in the bar scene swallowing the gun ammo.
That was nuts.
That's hardcore.
Yeah. That kind of sets the scene because then you go, okay, these guys are pretty like crazy badasses, you know, so don't mess with them kind of thing.
But back to the soundtrack, that's one of the other things that sort of drew me. But so Burn from The Cure,
yep.
Big Empty from Stone Temple Pilots,
yeah.
So just like the classic, like I don't know, just the film overall, the soundtrack, the that's what it has for the listing, it just has the names,
yeah, because there's a bunch of bands that I know on there that are, I can't recall off the top of my head, but are
yeah, like the
really really good.
Burn was like so written by Robert Smith, so from the
yeah that's
performed
the
by The Cure. Big Empty, which is another classic song,
but it was great because all those songs really came together in the film for atmosphere,
exactly,
and
like it made
setting
the
scenes and stuff like
exactly.
that. So it worked out really well.
Like The Burn, there's been a couple remakes of The Burn by the different artists, mm-hmm. but.
So I don't think you can, if you go, okay, we're going to listen to the soundtrack, you can definitely peg which scene, you know, the songs were in.
Oh, no, for sure.
Right? So that's what I like about it when a film can do that. And I think that's why, going back to the Rapid Fire one, when I heard the you know, Neil Sean's band, Hardline, that was like, oh, yeah. So when I listened to that, I'm like, oh, there's that scene and there's that scene.
Or the 80s electronica music in the first
one. In the first one? Oh, my gosh, that was bad. Yeah, that made it really be cheesy.
But the storyline, the fighting, 10 out of 10. Like, I'd watch this movie.
Yeah, it was a pretty solid film.
But definitely, I enjoy the movies that you brought up, Jody. Like, I can't wait to see what the next movies we have.
There is one quote, just before we end, that I wanted to mention, which I love. Brandon, I think he mentions it in one of his interviews. It's by Paul Bowles, I believe is his last name. The book's called The Sheltering Sky. And basically it says this, and I just love this, and it does apply to a lot of things. The quote goes like this. It says, because we don't know when we will die, we get to think of life as an inexhaustible well. Yet everything happens only a certain number of times, and a very small number, really. How many more times will you remember a certain afternoon of your childhood, an afternoon that is so deeply a part of your being that you can't even conceive of your life without it? Perhaps four or five times more? Perhaps not even that. How many more times will you watch the full sunrise? Perhaps 20, and yet it all seems limitless. And it kind of brings it back to how fragile we are as humans, and how, you know, you just never know when your time may come, right? So, you know, live your day at the fullest, and that's true.
Oh, definitely. Well, we just got to go for a commercial break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about a little bit how you got into martial arts.
Sure, cool.
See you guys in a bit.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
Hey, K2 here from We Got the Geek. Not only am I your favorite podcaster, but I'm also your Scentsy independent consultant. Scentsy offers a safe, wickless alternative to scented candles. We sell ceramic warmers that use a low wattage light bulb to warm our specially formulated wax cubes infused with fragrance. With over 80 scents available, I'm sure you'll find a few favorites. We also offer stuffed animals that have a scent pack included, broom sprays, travel tins for your car or locker, and our new Layers line of fragrance that lets you build a new fragrance wardrobe layer by layer, from your skin to your clothes. Contact me for a catalog, to smell some yummy samples, or to book a party. We're also hiring. Ask me about joining my team. Email me at kstu.wickless@me.com or on my website, kstu.sensi.ca.
And welcome back. This is myself, Ryan, and co-host Jody.
Jody here.
In the martial arts edition of We Got the Geek. And again, hoping to be many. Hopefully try to do this once a month. We just finished reviewing The Crow. Again, I'll watch that movie till who knows when the cows come home. But I think how we got on the topic of doing martial arts, Jody, is I think on our day job, I think we just started discussing, first of all, I think it started in the comics, and then it just moved on to like the type of martial arts. And I found out that you actually been practicing martial arts in different forms over the last few years. What are you doing currently? I think because you actually practice with a friend who comes from Toronto or who travels all over.
Well, I've been traveling around to different places studying. My history goes back a ways. So, like I was mentioning when back in 91, we were talking about, or 92, Rapid Fire. So I was kind of in my karate phase at that point in time. So basically my story is I started, everyone starts out in karate. It's kind of like a given, more or less, especially if you're in North America. So I ended up doing karate, I think starting at when I was about 10.
Okay.
So then I kind of dropped for a bit. And then a couple years later, I started picking it up. And, you know, I'm about 13 at that point in time. So I started getting kind of serious with it. And so I studied all the way up till I was in kind of at the point where I was going to do my black belt. So I was in the phase of getting ready for my grading and studying all my stuff that I needed to do to pass. And our club actually had a were invited to a function that was going on where they were. I was up at Brock University, and they were ended up wanting to showcase different arts. So it was kind of an open invitation. So there was a group of Muay Thai guys that came down from a local club. And then there was the Jeet Kune Do guys that came down. So this is where my life kind of took a detour. So I ended up hitting my brown belt status, going for my black. And then I saw the Jeet Kune Do kind of their forms they were doing, and just their the way they move and everything was very much realistic, very much like street based. And I was like, yeah, I can see myself doing that. Muay Thai guys, they're kind of crazy. They're doing like a lot of stuff off the shins, and I'm like, oh, I don't know about that, right? So I really liked the Jeet Kune Do stuff. So I ended up going down onto the floor after their presentation was done. It was a demonstration is what they were doing. So they were showing a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. So I went down, talked to one of the guys, and he was like, oh, I'm from Toronto, so I don't really teach it here. But there's a couple guys that I know. So he introduced me to these two fellows, and I ended up saying, hey, you know, how much, where, you know, why are you guys doing this, all that stuff. So they ended up giving me their cards, they'd give me a call. So I ended up contacting them, going, and that was kind of the start of my Jeet Kune Do aspect of things. So I had done that for a number of years, which then led me into the Filipino arts, because they kind of go hand in hand.
Now, the Filipino arts, I think that's more, from what you told me, the weapons.
Right. That's in karate, you do it, they start you out empty hand, you work your way up, and as then you get your higher belts, then you get into weapons. And sometimes it's like the black belt before they even start the weapons and the training. So in the Philippines, though, they do it different. They start you off with weapons. So you're, you know, doing the stick or the sword and that sort of thing. And then they work down into empty hand. So they believe that the weapons are going to be faster than your hands. So they want your eye and hand coordination to be there. They also work the right side of your body and left side of the body. So you have this coordination that's going to be a little bit better than, say, someone in karate who mainly might do just one side.
So instead of just if you're left-handed, they make sure that you're good in the right hand
right.
as well.
So most people, it's right-hand dominance, and then this way they have your left hand trying to be as equal or, you know, it for some people it'll be always be a little less. But they start you off with weapons. And then you go down from there. And then it goes into a bunch of other things aside from that. So that's kind of like where I am now. I've been studying various Filipino arts from Modern Arnis to Cali Lestrissimo to Lameco to...
Wow.
That's the kind of... I think that would be most of the systems I'd have been studying. FCS Cali and that sort of thing. So...
That's a lot of different styles. I didn't know you were doing that much.
Yeah, but it's all kind of the same, but just different aspects of it.
Because so I think, because you've gone to Toronto for that, and in fact, a couple times you've gone to Toronto where your teacher primarily teaches, doesn't he?
He comes down to, I have a couple teachers in Toronto, and this one comes down and teaches us now. So that's really cool. He likes to travel and meet different people.
That's cool.
So I've been with him for right now. It's only been about 4 months or so. So that's pretty new on that aspect of it.
Is that the only one you're currently?
No, there are
so
other
ones. So you're actually following. You're actually doing those other ones right now too.
The Cali Lestrissimo I do as well on the side.
Oh, wow.
As well, and it's very. Knife based,
okay.
Or sword in that case. So it's a whole different ball game with those guys than the stick related. But everything transitions and over very well. So whether you're picking up a stick or a sword, it all is the same. So like with the swords in that case, knives, you have to kind of like. Kind of kick over into your headspace,
okay.
And the fact that you're dealing with the fact that you're, we're talking about taking someone's life here, right? So it's
not necessarily defensive, or it's sort of both.
It is, and it's not. You know, if you want to get into a situation, you want to defend yourself. Basically, my teacher said to me once. He says, "The best way to look at it is you want to leave the situation." To go home to your wife, your kids, your family, because you want to be alive.
After
the confrontation, right now it's like one of those cases where you have the potential to take someone else's life, but that person also has the potential to take your life. So you would want to make sure that you're doing everything you can possibly to make sure you're going back to the wife and kids and make sure you're seeing them.
Now, if I recall you saying, isn't this the fighting style like the Philippines military?
Some of it is definitely in there through some of the other stuff that I've studied. Paquita Tertia is the main fighting style that is taught to the Philippine Army, actually. And I know the U.S. Army probably touches on that as well. So my teacher actually does the Paquita Tertia stuff through his teachers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting how you have, there's probably more than hundreds of different forms of the martial arts, but one leads into the other, that there's always a family branch that leads to like one main.
Yeah, and some of these are strictly family based.
Really? So
it's been handed down from father to son to grandfather to son to, you know, and so on and so forth. So
it's funny that you mentioned that. I think isn't there, I apologize if I'm mistaken, but there's a Jewish form of fighting. I gotta research that more.
Oh, okay. You're talking from Israel.
Would you consider it martial arts? I think it would be, but it's...
Their military is based on that.
But it's just strictly, it's not even necessarily the military, it's a form of fighting style that's been around since...
Krav Maga, I believe is what it's called.
That sounds familiar. It'd be interesting when we can...
I've dabbled a little bit of that, and I really like that stuff. It's very interesting, because you're dealing with also gun disarms, and then you're dealing with weapons, and that sort of thing. It is an open hand, empty hand as well, right? What happens when you lose your weapon against this person, and all of a sudden he's weaponed and you're not? How do you deal with it? Or you're both empty hand, you know? So,
yeah.
And they also deal with more than one-on-one. They deal with, like, groups. You know, you got three guys, people on you, or
more. So the ultimate multitasking would have to be.
So, you have to definitely be well-trained in a lot of these kind of areas, which is interesting.
Well, I can't fathom you got to figure what I knew was like karate. I mean, it's just over the years, just knowing that there's so much more out there, especially you have one individual that knows more than just the one fighting style.
Yeah. Well, that's what Bruce was doing. He was taking a look and studying all these different styles, and he basically took the common thread in a bunch of them, pieced them together so they flowed from one to the next. For him, it was all about ranges. Because you fight in a short range, you fight in a long range, you fight in the middle, and it's all about transitioning between those ranges. And you can see that in fight scenes, right? They're doing high kicks. The next thing you know, they're getting in close. The next thing you know, they're on the ground. And then you have ground fighting, which is a whole new ball game, which you see in the UFC with a lot of MMA stuff, right? But that's different. That's sports related to, you know, if you're out on the street, I don't want to take someone down because, you know, he's got his buddies sitting there and they're going to jump in and they're just going to take the boots to you, you know? So it's kind of dangerous in that case. So I really don't want to, you know, go to the ground in that case if you're on the street. Yeah, it's not a good place to go. But if you do it for sports, by all means, yeah, that's what it's geared for.
Now, you're saying some of the different groups that you participate in. Is there anything you'd like to
let I'd like to give a shout-out to my buddy Sean Tyler, who I've known for a number of years and met at many seminars that we go to. He's like-minded like me. In the case that we like to branch out and study from different teachers and that sort of thing. So he ended up doing FCS Kali. Now, FCS part is Filipino Combat Systems, and his teacher is Tuan Ray Dinaldo, who I've met and been to many seminars, and he's like one of the top teachers out there today. Very, very much in high demand, does a lot of seminars, you know, all over the world. And Sean's place is called Raging Tiger Martial Arts. They also do Muay Thai.
Okay.
So if you're interested in that, the Science of the Eight Limbs is technically what it's called, then you can take Muay Thai there. You can take the FCS Kali aspect of things. So if you want to learn more about the Filipino martial arts, great guy to go to. Really knows his stuff. And I think they're bringing in a karate teacher as well. That's kind of new, so I don't know too much about that. But you can check him out. He's at 80 Dynamic Drive, Unit 24 in Scarborough. He's online at www.ragingtigermartialarts.com. And you can contact him either by phoning him. He's at 416-892-8092, or you can email him at info@ragingtigermartialarts.com. So for those people kind of in the Scarborough area or Toronto area and want to, you know, intrigued by our podcast today and want to learn more about that stuff, by all means, check him out. He's awesome.
Should go check it out. Well, Jody, I think we've reached that time. I think we did pretty well today on our podcast, our first of many.
Yeah, this is the first that we put together.
So I can't wait to see what we do on our next one. And again, thanks to our
awesome producer,
Jay Stu.
Oh, thank you.
But I think tonight we'll end. We'll see you guys on the flip side.
Have a good one, guys.
Thanks for listening. To hear more We Got the Geek, check us out at www.wegotthegeek.com and on iTunes.